We'd Like a Word.
Welcome back to We'd Like a Word with me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colvin.
We're talking about how trauma can shape stories that we write. We've got author Jeff Gudgeon, who's the writer of Draca, and the former head of the General Staff, General Sir Peter Wall, who's also president of Combat Stress. We've been talking about Draca. Jeff, let's hear a bit from it.
I'm going to read two excerpts. There's just three paragraphs, two in Jack's voice and one in George's voice. Jack's the damaged hero, and there's lots of light in the book as well. So there's laughter, there's love, there's all sorts of things. It isn't all dark.
But yes, there's a lot of sex. There's a lot of fruity sex.
To understand some of Jack's mentality, I'm going to read you two paragraphs which show you some of his mindset. Getting to sleep was usually easy, with a little liquid help. It was staying asleep that was the problem. One summer when Jack was a kid, the family stayed on a farm for their summer holidays, and the farmer set a magpie trap in his yard. In the centre, in a little cage within a cage, was a live one. A call bird, the farmer said. He'd left it a dish of water and even a bit of dead pigeon to eat, but the thing flapped around, making a lot of noise in that harsh, rattling way of magpies. As Jack and the farmer watched from inside his barn, three more magpies arrived and hopped down through the wire door to see what all the fuss was about. They went frantic when the farmer walked over and they couldn't get out, and he shot them, one by one, with a .22 rifle he kept for vermin. The Taliban hadn't killed Jack outright, because he was their call bird. They'd used Dusty Miller for target practice. It was usually Dusty who woke Jack in the black hour before dawn, and always with the same pleading look. That way he'd stared at Jack as if he could do something. Dusty had come running back for him through the firefight in a mad, heroic, suicidal dash, and he was still coming back for him, pulling him out of the fog of sleep when the alcohol drained from Jack's system and all that was left was the sour taste of guilt. Sometimes, in those first moments of wakefulness, Jack could smell roasting meat. Then he'd have to walk outside and breathe clean air, whatever the hour, whatever the weather. He'd have run if he could. In summer, the air before dawn can be pure as snow. As I say, there are bits there are happier bits, but to understand Jack, you have to understand what he's been through. Let me introduce you to George. George is a feisty orphan with attitude. She's a girl who's made her way from care homes and foster homes to being manageress of the local boatyard. And here she is at a funeral, and for the first time she's meeting Jack's family. And she's about to be introduced to Jack's mother-in-law. Now, she's already seen Jack's mother-in-law in operation, who's a rather grand woman she calls the Duchess. When the mother-in-law greets people, she offers her hand palm down, fingers drooping, as if she expected them to go down on one knee and kiss it. So here's how George, the orphan with attitude, handles that sort of situation. Jack waved when he saw George. Nothing too enthusiastic, but enough for her to wander over and say hello. She was ready for the mother-in-law's fingers. If you slide your hand under that kind of regal greeting, then grip and twist, you can turn it into a proper handshake. The Duchess didn't like that. She didn't like George's looks neither. The Duchess was tall enough for her eyes to be at the level of George's hair, and George saw her wince. So what? George liked orange, and it's a strong colour, and it was only a streak. While Jack fumbled the introductions, the woman's eyes dropped, so she was looking down her nose at George's skirt, and her mouth pursed into a tight, wrinkly, cat's arse circle of disapproval. Maybe yellow was a bit bright for a funeral, but there wasn't much call for dark, smart stuff in a boatyard. At least George had put a decent jacket over it, and she bet the Duchess couldn't tell that the jacket came from a charity shop. There is George, and I have to confess that by the time I'd finished the book, I was a little in love with her. She's fey, she's feisty, she's attitude, and she is the light to Jack's dark.
Thank you very much indeed for that. We have some questions. Here's one about, this is for you, Jeff. This comes from another writer, Sue Clark. She says, your love of sailing and the sea shines through. Where does this come from? Do you have Scandinavian blood? There's a lot about Vikings in the book. There's a kind of a a backstory and the ghostly element. Do you have Scandinavian blood?
There are two questions in there. One is, do I have Scandinavian blood? The other is, where do I get my love of the sea? In terms of where the Scandinavian blood comes from, there are two stories about the origins of my name, Gudjon. One is that it's Danish, from the old Gudjon. And in fact, if you look where you found us in the 19th century, it was all in Danelaw. So there's one theory that we came over with the Danes. The other theory is that the Gudjon is a very small, easily caught fish. So it was a name that the Anglo-Saxons gave to someone who was a bit gullible and easily caught. On the whole, I prefer the Danish theory. So yes, please, I'll take the Viking history. And as for the love of sailing, my total experience of sailing, I shouldn't probably admit this, is 6 weeks, roughly, crewing for a friend in his boat. And it goes back to what I said. You go to write, you need a bit of experience and a bit of research and a bit of imagination. And I've experienced one serious storm under sail, and the waves get higher every time I tell the story. And you still write a book. But I read books by people who had sailed that type of boat under very severe conditions. So I'm fairly confident that what I was writing was accurate.
Okay, thank you. Well, another one here comes from Helen, who says, I would love it if you could ask about the methods of maintaining well-being when facing sudden issues and so many unknowns. I think there is a crossover with those in the NHS. So Helen's an NHS doctor. There's a crossover with those in the NHS during COVID, so would be grateful for any tips. Also, what care during and after a crisis will lessen the burden of PTSD later on? So, Peter, you're not a clinician, as you said earlier, but what have you picked up that might be useful there?
I think that the view in the military is that there's a very strong correlation between the quality of sort of supervision, management, and dare I say it, leadership that any organisation is experiencing and its ability to cope with setbacks and traumatic events. And that reflects in the impact on individuals. I mean, it's a collective thing, but also reflects on the level of vulnerability of individuals to that sort of thing. So the first thing I think that's really important as a preventative thing is make sure you've got as coherent a plan as you can get, a proper channel of communication, a chance for supervisors and leaders to maintain reasonably close contact with people and make regular assessments of their mood, behaviour, and so on and so forth. And something that the military puts great store in, which I'd recommend to anybody, is to have a sort of buddy-buddy system where everyone's got someone who's a reasonably close colleague and friend who can be a confidant, someone who can keep an eye on them. Because clearly, if you're supervising a significant number of people on a shift, everyone's very busy. You can't spend your whole time going around doing that sort of personal care type role. So I think that there's things you can be doing to enhance your resilience and reduce your susceptibility to these sorts of stress. There's a lot of evidence in the military space that those who've operated in cohesive teams, which is what normally happens on military operations, are less vulnerable than those who have to cope on their own. They might be an attached individual, a specialist, or perhaps someone like as a reservist who, when the operational tour ends, goes back to an environment where no one really understands what he and she has experienced. It's very difficult to relate to.
Jeff, anything to add? Sorry.
Yeah, well, there's a thing called trauma risk management, which the military has introduced in the last probably 10 to 15 years, which has been devised by clinicians and psychiatrists. And it's essentially a way of, some people would describe it as a mental poultice. It's a way of having conversations with people with whom you've had shared experiences to sort of talk about it in the aftermath, talk about how you're feeling about it. And it's thought to have a therapeutic impact that will reduce the susceptibility to subsequent mental health issues. And it also allows you to identify those at that point who are most vulnerable and might already need some sort of formal treatment. And that's now used very extensively in the military. People are trained on it in their normal course of events, and then they conduct these discussions now as a normal course of post-operational activity, whether it's a specific day in a conflict or whether it's at the end of a protracted period of exposure to those sorts of
things. I would think, from my personal experience, the most important thing to happen after trauma is to be able to have conversations with people who either share the experience or who are qualified. There's a great tendency amongst people, particularly in the armed forces, which is a fairly macho sort of environment. And when I was there, it was blokes that went out and were in the front line. If you're in that macho environment, A, you don't want to talk about something which is going to reveal something which makes you so vulnerable, which is probably going to make you crumble. You want to be the strong guy with your mates. So you've got to find some way of tapping in and letting those vulnerabilities out. And the other problem, of course, is that if you go into civilian life, no one around you has that experience. There is no one to whom you can talk, because the only people who would understand the level of trauma that you would experience is someone who's also worn a uniform and someone who can share, basically, the SH1T. So this is why I personally think the work of combat stress is so important, because it's very focused on the services, and you can get that sort of services camaraderie in there, which allows people to be themselves with people who understand. That, to me, is one of the crucial things. Talk early, talk to people who understand.
Another question. This question comes from listener Janice, and this is to you both. How have your careers followed what you imagined you'd be doing at the age of, say, 7 or 11? What did you want to be then, Peter?
Well, I didn't have a clue. I'd never thought about it. And, you know, even later on, perhaps when I was 15, 16, I really wanted to join the army because of sport, and I had a very short horizon. So it's a slight accident that I, you know, carried on for as long as I did.
Jeff?
I think when I was 7, my ambition was limited to wanting a bigger boat to sail on the pond. By the time I was 11, I probably wanted to join the Navy. So from 11, yeah, I wanted to be an admiral. Hey, great. I wanted to wear all the stripes.
I wanted to be a bricklayer. I wanted to be a bricklayer. Steve, what about you?
I wanted to be an astronaut. I'd just seen the moon landings at that age. I wanted to be on the moon, jumping around with Buzz and Neil and all the other guys.
Still time.
Now, we're very keen on bookshops, as you know, and things are very difficult for bookshops at the moment with COVID. So shortly before the lockdown kicked in properly, we went around and visited a few and talked to them. And we got a little recording now where Paul went and visited the Marlowe bookshop.
We've been coming in here at least once a week ever since they opened.
So how many books do you think you've bought?
Oh, how many? I've bought all the... This is the last one of these ones I've bought.
Yeah, but we spent £100.
Yeah. We spent £500 because we get a voucher every time we get to 100. So we've spent £500 on books.
You sound like the perfect customer.
Well, they're lovely people in here, and they go out of their way.
So what's this one?
This is Dorothy Sayers, Peter Wimsey's.
And this is Have His Carcass.
Yes. So this will be my last one of theirs.
So my name is Ray.
You've got beautifully made shelves.
Thank you.
I'm jealous.
My shelves are beautiful, yes. We have a very wide ranging stock. We usually only have one or two copies of each one, so that's partly what makes it a browser's paradise. So
what do you like reading?
What do I like reading? Everything, but particularly contemporary fiction. My favourite all-time book is The Colour Purple by Alice Walker, because it changed my life.
How did that happen?
Well, I did a lot less for money and a lot more for love. I think that's probably fair to say. At some stage, we all of us have a choice whether to live the kind of life that we want to live and that may be funded by the love that we have for the whatever we do, or to do it for the money.
Well, on a day-to-day basis then, what are the good things that happen in here?
Every day is colourful and interesting. You walk in, the lighting's great, and the books are colourfully displayed. front-facing, most of them, so that you can see the covers, and so much thought and ingenuity has gone into the design of them. I mean, I could stand here and not do anything and still enjoy myself, because obviously I've got a paradise of places to go just by picking up a book.
Is it a bit annoying when people come in and distract you, because you could just be sitting here reading? Wouldn't that be lovely?
Because the second best thing I like is talking to people, so...
We'd have to mention our wonderful customers, particularly one who brings us in homemade cakes and biscuits on a weekly basis.
And what's your name?
So, my name is Maria, and we have to give a shout out to Neil, don't we?
We do. Neil is absolutely our favourite customer. I was here, I think it was my first day. Neil has an absolute passion for books, I think maybe even exceeding our own. And he also loves baking, so he came into the shop and welcomed me, with a breakfast muffin, which I thought, I'm going to love this job.
And tell me about some more of your customers.
People that will come in weekly, perhaps. We really get to know them. We understand something of their likes and dislikes, and we'll often say to each other, oh, here's a book that I think Martin would like, or here's one that, this is definitely on Monica's list. I sometimes say it's a bit like being, an intellectual barmaid or something like that, in as much as we get to know quite a lot of our regular community. And we have a customer loyalty scheme, you know, one of those things where you collect points. And we've got, I think we're over 11,000, aren't we? Which is remarkable, I think. People really treasure
it. And have you considered having draft ale or beer brought in here? So you could be an intellectual barmaid like other ones.
We think of little else.
You think of little else, fair enough.
We do, yes. In fact, you know, I think Maria's idea is that we should have a still in the back and then we could brew our own gin. Bookshop gin, there's an idea.
We do have something that's quite entertaining is when people come in and say, oh, now, there's a book I really want. It's got a blue cover. You know, you get lots of things like
that. Well, that's
that.
Obvious.
Yes.
So what do you give people when they say that?
Blue cover.
Like, do you have a go-to range? We've got a blue one, a red one, a green one.
I might go for North Water by Ian Maguire over there, or We the Drowned, or... There are many books with blue covers, but it's quite funny, the assumption that people think that you will automatically know, or it's written by a woman. But I have to say that very often we can find it.
What local authors do you have?
Jane Fallon. She lives in London, but they also, I think, have a place in Marlow, and they're down every weekend, more or less. She's very popular. In fact, she's particularly popular in America, and whenever she publishes a new paperback, she tweets about it, and we get lots of orders in for copies to be packed and posted to America. And then we get lots of good tweets from people in the States saying how pleased they were to get them.
We know Jane Fallon as the long-term partner of Ricky Gervais. Jane has a following of magical people who really love their cats. And when Jane brings a new book out, she tweets to her worldwide cat-loving fans that there's a new book out at her local bookshop, and we can post it, and indeed we do. We gift wrap and we send it to all corners of the world.
She's like your international ambassador for this shop.
She is. It's fantastic, yes. So I don't think anyone is really interested in her connection with Ricky Gervais. I think they're interested in her because she's a great writer. You know, her books are very readable and fun. But also the cat people are a particular breed, I think. I mean, there's no pun intended there, but they just are. So there's a kind of avidity about the longing for the next Jane Fallon book. And people have actually had 8 packaged up and sent to them in Australia. And then we get pictures back of their cats opening the packaging, the cats with the book, the cats and how much they love the new book.
I suppose you have to get one for each cat.
Well, maybe they do, yes.
The dogs would be happy to share.
Yes. In fact, I've just thought maybe that's what she needs to do, is because she has a much-loved cat herself. So she could get the cat to put a paw print in each of her books, and then that would, you know, open up a whole new market, wouldn't it?
She's just a front for the cat, I think. The cat's the one writing it. This is what it's all about, using humans. Mm. Oh, I'm just being shown Instagram pictures of dogs. I thought it was all about cats.
Well, dogs. We... at the bookshop are more dog people than cat people, I have to say. So
see, I felt that.
But I didn't want to spoil the whole Jane Fallon cat thing.
Yes. I don't want to upset you, Jane, if you ever hear this, but yes, we love dogs more than cats. And so we welcome them in with open arms, and many dogs have come to learn that because we have an open door policy, as they
I've got Bonio behind the counter.
Yes, and gravy bones in the little jar for the smaller dogs. So the dogs bring their owners in. Right. One or two of them actually come in happy expectation and give us a little bark, don't they, if they don't get their biscuit quickly enough.
So I'm just being shown picture after picture after picture of dogs in the shop and at the counter.
These are just some of our happy canine customers that that come into the shop, and they choose their favourite books, and then we put them on Instagram. And I think the Dogs of Marlow Bookshop has a better following than we ourselves do. Yeah, but you can see why. I mean, they're adorable. My favourite so far has been the Great Dane that was so big he could just rest his chin on the counter without having to stretch at all.
I had a funny incident once, which is where I was standing on the side of the counter here serving Andrew, was, and unknown to the customer on the other side, Andrew's dog Ronnie was down there, and I, in my sort of, you know, cringy dog loving voice, said, "Ronnie, hello, would you like a biscuit?" And this went on, and then they left, and I turned around and the woman was staring at me.
"Can I have a biscuit too?"
She said, "I thought you were talking to the man." You know. And why not? That was quite funny, actually.
I loved visiting the Marlow Bookshop. They were so bubbly and friendly, and I believe that it's your favourite bookshop, Jeff.
It is. It's the nearest independent bookshop to my home, and it's a few miles away, but whenever I can, I drop in there, and they know their stuff, and they're always so friendly. I love them to bits.
Steve, we have a question to clear up from the previous episode.
We do, from Dougie Brimson. He posed the question on the last episode we recorded, which was, what was his favourite book when he was a child? Now, there's been some contention with this, hasn't there?
Well, there's some people have got in touch. Yeah, he told us his answer, but other people have said that kind of he's wrong. I'm going to side with Dougie now, seeing as it was his question.
I think so, as he posed the question. Now Dougie said that his favourite book was The Hobbit, whereas apparently people who've done a bit of research online and hunted him down have found interviews where he said that his favourite book was Lord of the Rings.
I think we'll just say that Tolkien was an author of whom he was particularly fond of. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Anyway, well, on that happy note, I think we're coming to the end of this episode of We'd Like a Word, which has featured Draca, the book by Geoffrey Gudgeon, the man who puts plastic explosive under your chair, and General Sir Peter Waugh. What kind of a military have you been running here when you've got people like Jeff Gudgeon? Although admittedly he was in the Navy. So thank you very much, General Sir Peter Waugh and Jeff Gudgeon. I'm Paul Waters.
I'm Stephen Colgan. Thanks very much for listening. See you soon. Bye.
Thank you, guys.